Hi, this is Elizabeth Grayson, Amanda from Highlander. Check out my new young adult novel called Chillily. It's out in ebook right now on Amazon and all the other platforms out there in the world. Check it out. It's a romantic fantasy, and I'd love for you to read it. You are listening to the Fandom Podcast Network.
Welcome, everyone, to Blood of Kings, Episode 5, a Highlander podcast here on the Fandom Podcast Network. On this show, we cover all things Highlander, as you know, including guest interviews, the movies, TV shows, books, and in this show, particularly the collectible card game, special events, and more. I'm Norman Lau, one of your Blood of Kings hosts. Kevin, lucky dog, is on special assignment right now for the Watchers Tribunal, and he is tripping around the world and trying to find immortals for our chronicles. So he will not be joining us today for this show, but I have a special guest for us, someone who is very near and dear to me, and we will meet him in just a second. But first, let's go over a little bit of what's happening in the news of Highlander today. As we're recording this show for July 2nd, Colin Pelton, who is a friend of Blood of Kings, is starting his live tweet for Highlander, starting with the very first episode. So you can follow Colin at Colin Pelton. That's C-O-L-L-I-N-P-E-L-T-O-N. And he is doing it in concert with Adrian Paul's The Sword Experience, which just finished up its tour in Germany and is headed towards its next location. So you can always follow The Sword Experience and Adrian Paul on their respective social media pages. That's The Sword Experience, and I know a lot of us out there want to join that as well. And coming up soon, especially for you Southern California fans, on July 23rd at Dark Delicacies, that's 3512 West Magnolia Boulevard in Burbank, California, from 2 to 4 p.m., Adrian Paul will be there to sign his two-disc collected edition audiobook, My Immortal Journey. And from personal experience listening to that book, that is an absolute must-have for Highlander fans because it is probably one of the more extensive collections of his Highlander memories, and it is definitely worth a buy, and it's definitely worth meeting Adrian. Adrian is doing a really great job right now trying to extend himself to the fans and meet all of you out there and share with you his personal experiences with Highlander and sign stuff for you, and who knows, there might be even more. I don't know if there's going to be any guest experience other guest stars showing up for that, but you never know. So again, on July 23rd, 2016 at Dark Delicacies in Burbank, California, Adrian Paul will be signing his book for the Peace Fund. So enough of all that. That's all the stuff that I needed to cover for the Watchers Tribunal. And now for the really fun stuff, because I'm really excited here today on Blood of the Kings, because in the studio with me, well, not technically in the studio with me, in the studio across the United States from New Jersey, is one of my oldest friends and probably one of the reasons why I'm still in touch with Highlander as much as I am today, because he and I started this journey together a long time ago. My good friend and fellow Highlander aficionado and enthusiast, Mike Sellers. Mike, how are you, my friend?
I'm good, Norm. How you doing?
I'm good. So it's been a long time, you and I, with
real
this whole,
long time.
With this whole Highlander thing. And I'd like for you to just kind of like let the listeners know a little bit about you, who you are, what you're doing right now, and kind of like how we got into this whole Highlander collectible card game thing.
Okay, well, my name's Mike Sellers. I'm an art instructor at the Kubert School and a cartoonist and a comic book artist. And currently I'm working on my own self-publishing project, and I still teach at the Kubert School. And I was your art teacher in school back in 95.
And that's right, Mike. I started the Joe Kubert School in 1995. And I think you were one of my first instructors. And there was a really really interesting evening that we had. I think it was you and me and James. And we went out to a pool hall because I think it was the summertime maybe. And we just needed to find things to do because around school it was either bowling or the pool hall or hanging out at the Dover Star Diner, having disco fries or the Travelers. I don't even know if those places are around anymore. Are they?
Dover Star is still there, but yeah. Travelers is long gone.
Oh, that's too bad. They made good disco fries.
Yeah.
And then because my apartment complex was kind of like right in the middle between school
and the diner.
And the diner. Yeah, we decided we were going to go back and we were going to go to the movies, I think, one night. And then I needed to pick up something from my apartment. And while we were waiting, I think I handed you, and this was the fateful night, people, where I think our lives changed. Definitely our bank accounts changed.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. When I handed you, I think, either a deck or a handful of cards for Highlander. Now, I didn't buy those myself. Back in Fandom Flashback on the Fandom Podcast Network, Highlander, the Fandom Flashback episode number 4, I talked about how I got into the game the first time, and my roommate at the time, he actually bought a booster pack or booster box of those Pepto-Bismol nasty pink packs, and he kind of dumped them all over my head when I was sleeping because I was exhausted from homework, probably from Mike. and then I opened them up and I see, you know, I'm a Highlander fan. I looked at them. They had great pictures. So I decided to see what the game was all about. So I didn't have anyone to play against. And I know, Mike, you are a Highlander fan. We were watching the TV show together at the time. We weren't really like super enthusiastic about the show, but being science fiction and fantasy fans, it was the only thing really for us that was on the air that we could really get into, unless it was like Star Trek or I don't even know what else was on, but That fateful night, it was when we started thinking about really going to the card game in earnest. Do you remember what happened? Do you remember when I gave you those cards or that pack and what may have prompted you to move forward with the game with me?
The way I remember it, and granted, I'm older than you, so you can take it with a grain of salt. we had gone back to, we were playing pool, and me, you, James, and I think Brent McKee went back to your place, and James and Brent went to go get a copy of The Color of Money, and we were going to watch that at your place.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
But they took like 60 hours. So while we were sitting there waiting, you started showing me the card game, and I was like, oh, this is, and because we both liked the Highlander TV show. Mm-hmm. And so we just started, you know, going back and forth to and I'm like, so how do you play this? So we started playing. So by the time those guys got back, like 2 hours later, like we were already full into a game and like, didn't want to stop.
Is that when we had that legendary like quality blade like like misruling where we kept adding points to our quality blade?
We kept laying them out.
Yeah, no, that you're right. Now, before we get like more into the card game, for the TV show, do you remember when you got into the TV show or the movie?
The movie was the first movie was my first exposure. I caught it on. I lived in Baltimore at the time, and I was in a Earl's video games, video store. And I was just walking up and down the aisles looking for something to rent.
So is this one of those kind of mom and pop stores?
It was a chain, but it was like, you know, like how they used to, like a lot of people nowadays probably won't remember what a video store was like, you know, where you had the racks of VHS and because that's how long ago it was VHS.
Right.
So this is probably like 1987, I guess, 86, 87. Like, you know, once the movie, like usually back then it was like 6 months later, they would come out on VHS. Mm-hmm. So I was just wandering around looking for something to rent. That was one of the things I picked up and rented because I just like guy on the cover with a sword. I'm there.
Okay, so that's what drew you into finding, like, there was a guy in trench coat, sword, boom, I'm going to go and...
I think it was the shot of Connor that's, like, on the, like, his card, you know, like, the big tartan, like, this thing.
Yeah, okay. Gotcha.
So, like, he was, it was just a cool-looking cover with a guy with a sword, and it says, like, something that can be only one and whatever other, you know, copy it had on the VHS case. So I took it home, rented it. I must have watched it like 6 times before I took it back to the video store in like a 24-hour period.
That's right.
I was just like, rewind, watch it again. Like, this is so cool. And then after that, it was, you know, I was a fan of it. And one night, I guess probably after the show, I didn't see Highlander the series until I just happened to be up late one night and I was just flipping through the channels, probably after a long day of drawing comic books. And I caught like I guess it was the Hunters episode.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
The season finale of season one where they had the Hunters
yep.
and like they're, and that pretty much, it was one of those things where it left just enough, like left me questioning just enough that I needed to find out what was going to happen next. Mm-hmm. And then I guess that they were like, you know, rerunning the series at the time. So I actually wound up going right into the second season, you know, with the Watchers. And then, so after that, I was pretty much, you know, every, I think it was like Saturday nights at like 1 o'clock in the morning or something like that. Yeah, that used to come on USA.
They changed it. It was like, it was earlier than that. And then I don't remember why they made the time change, but maybe because they had to fit in something like Silk Stockings or La Femme Nikita or something like that, that was going on at USA. But you and I had this ritual, folks. This is like in all seriousness, Mike and I would literally record the show. And then right as the show ended, we would call each other and we would completely like dissect the show like immediately. Like, why was that quickening so big? He was only like 100 years old, or that sword fight was like the best sword fight we ever saw. And that was probably Duende, because you and I you were a big Ottavio Canzone fan. Still are.
Duende is still like one of my, and it was great too. Like with Duende, I remember there was a martial arts magazine out at the time and they did a write up on Anthony DeLongis. Mm-hmm. And he was going over the whole circle fighting style that was actually real. And like he, you know, adapted for the TV show. There's a big article about it. Somewhere in my mass collection of crap, I have like that issue still. It was just a fascinating, because I've always been interested in sword fighting. I actually took fencing for like a brief while.
I know this is radio, folks, and not TV, but I do see a fencing foil right over your shoulder, Mike. On the top of one of your cabinets.
It's my old practice foil for when I was fencing.
So when the immortal buzz happens, that's exactly where Mike is going for. Now I know where your sword is.
No, actually my sword's on the other side of the bookcase here. It's my katana.
Which one?
The dragon head red scabbard.
The red scabbard one. Cool. Both.
Yeah, but
the ones that we bought from the Quality Blade card. Right.
I think actually I got it at the Baltimore con that we went, the Highlander con we went to.
Okay.
I think I bought it down there, like, because I was working in comics and single, and I had more money than sense. So.
yeah. I think we were probably both a little bit more cash flush before we got into Highlander.
Yeah, definitely.
But that goes well out with like a lot of the fans, and one of the things that I brought up in the fandom flashback is when Highlander came out, there weren't really a lot of collectibles until the series started putting out like the VHS tapes and some of those collectibles in the catalog. But when that all discontinued from retail and from online, not online ordering, but on the phone ordering, excuse me, there wasn't online back then. The only thing that was really out that we could collect like consistently from pretty much 95 to around 99 was the card game. And we bought a ton of cards, Mike. Of cards. And let's talk about that a little bit. When we first really wanted to go deep into the game, distribution for trading cards, at least around 95, 96, isn't like distribution now. You just can't go to Amazon or Cool Stuff Inc. or your local online retail. You had to find a brick and mortar store and actually go and buy cards. And because of the way that our finances were at the time, you and I and Warren... And Warren, I promise I will get you on a future show. And maybe, I think it was Chuck, maybe he was with us, Chuck Oliver?
I think Chuck kind of came in, because he was my roommate at the time.
Right.
So he came in and in there. And Mike Chen, I think, was probably the other one.
Right. So we all kind of took a look at it, and we put our collective dollars and cents together, and we bought boxes of cards.
I think what had happened, if my memory serves, again, like I said, I'm older than you, so it's a little fuzzy at times, but...
You're doing way better on the memories than I am right now.
Well, I've been up for several hours, so...
I need more coffee.
But I remember I went to I think it was the 1995 San Diego Comic-Con as a guest. I was like, I was working on the Nightwing miniseries at the time.
Okay.
So I was there signing, and I had my Highlander backpack that I had, you know, that I got with the first, like probably the first season of
the VHS.
VHS. Mm-hmm. So I had that on, and I was walking through the crowd, you know, just being a nerd, and some lady came up and like tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Hey," and she just handed me like some Highlander cards.
Really?
And I was like, what? And so it was, and if I butcher her name, I'm terribly sorry, but it was Mary Lee Holtzheimer.
Yeah, sure.
She handed me a promo card, like one of the promo cards they had at the time, and like her business card in like a little sleeve, and she just handed them to me. And like, so we wound up, I think our first initial big order, we got a case of cards.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
So I think we'd gotten them through her. And so like, and you were helping me, you were inking backgrounds for me at the time, mm-hmm. like at the Kubert School. So everything was shipped there. Warren came up, and we just had this massive opening party. And I don't even want to think. I think, did we buy like 2 cases, I think it was?
I think so. I don't remember how much we bought, but we got into the game with the Pepto-Bismol set, which is, okay, folks, we lovingly say Pepto-Bismol set because literally the series edition TV set was wrapped in literally Pepto-Bismol pink cellophane. It was, we love the game so much that, you know, we continued on with it, but the very first set, and Mike, jump in here at any time, it was not the best printed set in the world because Thunder Castle Games, who produced it, they went with a vendor that was more in tune with printing actual playing cards like Hoyle or Ace or those type, where they have that really kind of a thicker stock, a little bit more glossier coating, but their four-color process on printing an offset was terrible. So those, they came out really muddy, but the card mechanics were so good that we loved it. We just kind of pushed through it until we got to the movie edition. So I'm going to roll this back before we like get into like the Uber unpacking. So you were at San Diego Comic-Con. Mary Lee Holtzheimer became, I think, basically our over the phone distributor.
Yeah.
And but where did we get the series edition stuff? Because I know that there was a store that we used to go to in near Elizabeth called Outer Limits. And that's where I got my cards from originally.
I think we wound up buying like a couple initial like boxes. She gave us a deal on like the booster decks and starter decks for like, yeah, you know, I guess she had like a pretty big stock of them at the time, mm-hmm. for the TV edition. So we bought a bunch of stuff off her for those.
Okay.
But when the movie edition came out, like shortly like after we got that, that's a bunch of boxes from her, and like that's when we went
whole hog
crazy. Yeah, crazy, just like, and I know we bought like at least 2 cases, so that's what, about like 12 booster packs. We split it between 3 of us, so it was a little bit, but we got a really good price from her. I think they were like $60 a box.
Yeah, right. Instead of retail would have been like 80, 85, 90.
Right.
At the time, because, you know, you're dealing with, at the time, so we're talking about 95, 96, the big games that were out, at least card game-wise. Magic was already set. I mean, Magic was pretty much the front runner. There were games I know the X-Files had a card game out. Vampire the Masquerade had a card game out.
Yeah, and they had, like, their werewolf game, too, if I remember correctly.
Was it a Rage game?
Rage, yeah, that was the other one that White Wolf had.
Right, and I think Pokemon was probably out by then. And
yeah, it was out, and like, but it was like, you know, much more kid oriented than what we were, you know, because like I always considered Highlander, the card game, to be like a fantasy chess game,
right?
Because it's like you gotta make your move, but you gotta think what the guy's gonna do next. So when you're putting out your cards, you need to like consider what's coming around the corner. Always keep that one dodge in the back of your hand so that you can like dodge away from a headshot if you have to.
Well, let's go into the mechanics then, because I think the mechanics is one of those things that really sold us on the game. So when we first started playing and we actually started understanding the rules, in the series edition, when we opened up those first starter decks, there were 4 rules cards, double printed. So basically, think about playing cards, and these were the only rules, playing cards with rules printed on both sides. And that's, I think, Mike, for you and I think that's when we actually really loved the game the most, because the rules were so simple. Yeah, errata on cards, and errata are rules that are fixed for future sets. There was no errata. The rules were very basic. And the core of the game, the actual Swordmaster system that Mike Sager at Thunder Castle Games created, is probably the best mechanics card game system I have ever played up until this time. And I know you feel the same way.
Yeah, it definitely. It's very precise and clean. And being a sword, you know, fantasy kind of nut, like it gives me, it makes you feel like you're in there, like right in the mix of it, you know, without actually having to take a sword to the gut. So, but it is easily the best system I've ever played. It's like, I've tried other card games trying to get that thrill again over the years. Nothing's ever come close. And some games are so convoluted with like the mechanics that like, it just sucks all the fun out of it. And unfortunately, but like Highlander was great at that. I mean, where you usually got into problems was with the event cards. Like, cause like the wording would sometimes, I remember we went out to a play at a store out in Long Island, like me, you and Warren. Mm-hmm. That's when we met Miguel. Miguel's buddy that was playing at the time. he was a real rules lawyer. So like he goes, no, it means blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. It's like, maybe he was a law student. I don't know. But I mean, so like, that's when one of our first encounters was going back and forth about like the meanings of the cards. So I remember when we used to do when I used to run those tournaments, me, you and Warren would sit down and agree upon this. And we would state at the beginning of the game, this is the errata we're going with.
Right.
So if you've got your deck built around a certain system, consider that now before you start playing.
Well, that's an interesting point that you bring up, because you were pretty much kind of like the center of the, would it be the New Jersey area, not Northern New Jersey or Southern New Jersey, but the New Jersey area.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot of like, I had me and Mike Chen, who's now my brother-in-law, wound up going to a tournament in somewhere like a little further south in Jersey that was at a Red Roof Inn. And it was run by a girl named Laura Jean Nefesi and her husband.
Oh, yeah. Oh, wow.
And like, that was the first tournament I'd ever gone to. And it was just kind of like, it's kind of freaky because like, you know, I was just usually playing with you and Warren and Mike. So it was just like, you know, very friendly, not very competitive. So it was a sealed deck tournament we went to. And so like now you're getting blasted with rules and errata and blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, so like you're just, and so like some 12-year-old's beating the snot out of me. You know, I'm like in my 30s at the time and Mike was probably in his 40s. Mm-hmm. And we're playing against like 11-year-olds and they're just like kicking the shit out of us.
Okay, so let's roll that back a little bit. So when we first started playing, it was just us.
Yeah.
It was just you, me, Warren, maybe Mike, maybe Chuck. And we were just playing, you know, either in my apartment or your apartment or in one of the studios at school. And all we knew of the card game was our own meta. Meta, for all of you non-card game players that are listening to out there, it's the arena and sphere of influence of your playing group at the time. So our meta was basically all we knew. And when you get used to playing with other players, you get to get used to their playing style, their cadence and timing of play. But one of the things that I loved when we started was Mike was so passionate about the game, he actually wanted to reach out and branch out and go to different places and meet new people and try the tournament scene. So I was kind of fearful of that. I mean, bravo to you. You went out there and just kind of like just did it, which is why you became our tournament organizer, because at the time we had to do everything through mail. Regular old stamp snail mail. And the errata came to us about as quickly as any regular mail, because that came through Castle News, the Thunder Castle Games newsletter. So things weren't as instantaneous as they are now. But, right?
Yeah, big time.
Yeah, so when you stepped into your first tournament scene, what compelled you to go? Was it your love for the game and you just wanted to expand your horizons more? Or did you feel like, did it bring out a competitive nature in you that you've never felt before?
I guess it was probably just more of just trying to like, you know, meet new people and see different things. And I just wanted to give it a shot. It was no real like competitive, cause I'm not uber competitive except when I'm in the game, then I'm like, you know, locked down, like let's get her done. But, it was just more of like, you know, just trying to expand our horizons. Cause at the time we weren't doing the tournaments. It was just like, you know, we would meet up like on, I think it was Thursday nights, and we would play some games. Mm-hmm. And we would try and suck in your fellow students and other people. And like, I remember like giving cards away. And I think we all did to a lot of the other guys like Frank and Will and those guys to try and just get more people built into the game. And like, so we could have more fun. So I initially started doing the tournaments just because like I had seen something somewhere online or heard about it or what, I can't remember. It was probably like an email chain or something that I got involved in. So me and Mike went down, played the game. Like I said, like got our butts handed to us by a couple of 11-year-olds. And that was like, Mike didn't like it. He was kind of a little bit turned off by it. I remember it was just like, okay, there's more to this game than what we've been playing. It's not just like hack and slash, you know, I tap you on it with an upper right attack and then you block it. And there's like more to the deck building. And that's when I came back from that one and I started talking to you guys and like, we started doing more with the deck building. And then when I went to, I think it was, I played in one of the tournaments at the Highlander Baltimore convention that we went to.
That was Syndicon, I believe.
Yeah, Syndicon, something like that. And I remember, like, you guys didn't play. I think the only one we did play in was at Sealed Deck Tournament where I played that 60-year-old woman.
Okay, let's talk about that. That's a good story.
That's a fun one.
Okay.
So we went down to this Highlander convention in Baltimore, and I want to say 1996.
Okay.
That's where I'm guessing that I think I remember being. And so Thundercastle Games had a couple reps there. Terry and Sam, I think it was.
Terry Eldred and Sam Orlando.
Yeah. So they were running a few tournaments over the course of this weekend. And Norm and I went to a Sealed Deck tournament. And he wasn't really keen on at the time on playing in tournaments, but we went anyway. It's Sealed Deck, so you really don't have to worry about like this major mojo that's going to come your way. You just open the cards. It's all about gameplay. So during the course of the tournament, it came down to me and this older lady who was a Highlander fan, because I guess she like thought Adrian Paul was cute. So that's why she was watching the show.
That's pretty par for the course.
Yep. And so during the Sealed Deck tournament, but I guess she played with her son a lot from what I remember her telling me. So like they played the card game quite often. So she had some pretty good basic skills. And we got into this really like, you know, back and forth, like take a shot. It finally came down. I beat her at zero because like I threw a card out that gave her 2 points of damage. Also gave me 2 points of damage and we were both down to like two cards. So, but by the time, like with the cycling of your cards and adjusting your ability, she went to zero before I did. So she lost.
Was that your first tournament win ever?
I think so. It was one that I remember, like, I mean, I just remember, like, I just loved, like, the back and forth, you know, like, the gameplay of it. Because there was, like, no, like, look, I have this uber special card I traded and paid $100 for. I have, it's just, like, basic cards, and you're just going back and forth, and your knowledge of gameplay is what's going to get you to win.
You know, that's what I felt about Highlander. I never felt that Highlander was really dependent upon like the big chase cards, even though that was still part of the chase card model where you could get you would find rare cards and they would enhance your deck. But I never felt like there was one card in the rare card pool that really kind of just locked you out.
Yeah, I mean, that came later. But I felt that pinch, like the next tournament I played over the weekend, it was a, you know, an open deck thing. The first movie edition to come out, I was playing a General Katana deck because he had some nice cards in there. But I played against another General Katana. The guy had a lockdown deck, so he would throw out a location, so I couldn't dodge. I could only back away, and then like, or it was something where you couldn't play special cards.
Okay.
So I pretty much could do the way he had it locked down. I could do nothing. So I would just have to burn five cards off the top of my deck. That was so boring, and I hated that so much. So then when I came back to, you know, when we got back to Jersey and we were playing, like, our you know, Thursday night tournaments, I was telling you guys about it, and you were all like, oh, that just sounds horrible.
Well, I think because, like I said, our meta group was a little bit more along the lines of, you know, let's try and treat this Swordmaster system like a duel. We even tried to like make themes in our decks that were a little bit more along the lines of what you would see in the TV series, because that's where I think Highlander was really hitting its stride. It was when the card game came out, it was around 95, and Highlander came out, the TV series came out in 92. So the third season of Highlander was really where the TV show kind of just took off.
Yeah, it was really gelling at that point.
Right. And now you had this card game as a property that kind of like helped fans connect with the TV show. And it was just a really nice syncopation between if I can't get the TV show, then I'm going to try and get my fill of Highlander with my friends and play this card game. So, but now we are exposing ourselves to all these different meta situations, and traveling to the tournaments was a lot of fun. I didn't do as much as I think you did. I did a couple. I mean, Syndicon, I think I did try one, but there were a couple of tournaments where we had some real showstopper games.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of them was, I don't remember the name of the tournament, but that's when you were really steamrolling with your signature Connor Mountain Cave headshot deck.
Yeah, that was the Shore Con in 1997. That's when I became the New Jersey state champion in 97.
Okay. All right. So how many, did you take any heads with that deck, and did you get any quickenings?
I did not take any. I think I took one or two heads with that deck, but the major play there on the mechanics was like, we're in the mountain cave. I can look at all of your attacks. You can't look at mine. So I just keep whittling away at you. Mm-hmm. And actually I'm rebuilding that deck now to play Warn, hopefully in a few weeks. But now I'm going to use, like, I'm going to add in the weapons of choice, arms and tactics stuff, like, so sabers, you know, like dueling blade and all that kind of stuff. So it was just a deck that, and then I had that one power play in there of like the, shouldn't give this away, but the Darius, which would allow me to bring in Kurgan's follow up, which, so I would do the Connor's Master Block, which would make my next attack unblockable. I would use Connor's Master's attack, which was undodgeable. So now I got an unblockable and dodgeable 2-point attack. And then I use Kurgan's follow-up, which would make the Master's Lunge unblockable and undodgeable. So I was getting you with 5 points of damage, like in one turn. So then I would do that, and then I would whittle you down with all of the you know, regular 2-point attacks that are hidden, or you'd burn cards. And then you would, you know, eventually I get you down low enough and I go for the headshot.
Was that your favorite deck?
I was one of the ones that I'm most proud of. After I played it a few times with you guys, though, you guys were getting all pissed off at me, so I stopped playing it. Because it was a beast, I got to say.
It's a good tournament deck. I mean, there's, so for the people out there that are listening that aren't really in tune with the card game, one of the things that is really fun to do with a collectible card game is try and find all the connective tissue between the cards and really looking at the collection, understanding all of the copy that is on these cards. I mean, literally, there was a time where I think we could probably flip through our binders and pages of cards. Someone could literally point to a card, and you and I, Warren too, could tell them exactly what was on the card, from the picture on the card to the name of the card to the subtext on the card to the quote that's on the bottom of the subtext of the card. To
the restriction,
the grid, everything. And we're talking like over 400, 500 cards, because when you go to tournaments, that's what you need to know. And that was, I mean, when you take it to that level, and I know a lot of tournament players do, that really does kind of allow you to really find great strategies within the cards. But sometimes you just don't have to be as complicated, and you can just throw a headshot out at the very first turn and shake someone loose and see if it actually connects, because that can happen sometimes.
Oh, yeah. My opinion, like, because we used to have one guy that used to play in our group that used to always build these monstrous, like, because there was no limit. Mm-hmm. Like, I guess I can name names. Gary used to always play these like 150, 600, 200 card decks. And the most of us usually played like around 60 to 75 cards, because that way you get a nice balance of like every three cards I should have something I need. It's right. Just basic math, you know? And like that was probably, I think I took Gary's head in that ShoreCon tournament, because he's fishing around for like a block, and there's a headshot coming that's hidden. So he was just kind of screwed, because he could never get any cards in his hand. And he got so mad at me. I do remember that.
Well, that's the name of the game. And let me tell you, folks, there is nothing, I think, probably more defeating than getting your head taken in a tournament. Because in a tournament, if you get defeated, you get to come back and play another day, as long as you maintain your head. It's kind of like the TV show. This is why the card game is so darn good, because it really does simulate what's going on with Highlander. In the game, you get to play a persona. And in that persona and the way that you build your deck, you get to tune that deck like the persona. You get to add cards on the side of your deck called quickening cards. If you want to simulate having multiple powers, you can do a lot of things to make your deck just absolutely a beast. But if you lose your head in the tournament, you automatically lose. You are out. And the quickening cards that are associated with your deck, they call them forced ante. It's probably one of the only times I've ever seen this happen in any game that I've ever played. Is once in a tournament, because it simulates what's going on with the Highlander lore, if you're playing with extra quickening cards, you have to surrender those cards to your opponent.
Only if they take your head.
Only if they take your head. That is like, because you're playing, if you had quickening cards, with a completely stacked deck, and technically you're dealing with the powers of multiple immortals in your deck. Multiple advantages.
Right.
So if you lose, you lose those advantages as well. And I always thought that was neat because I loved taking out people that had like one or two quickening cards. Because the only way, aside from that, to get a quickening card was to win a tournament and to have them mail that to you or to your tournament director, and he would get that.
Which would take forever.
Which would take forever. And there were, when we started, there were at least maybe 20 cards in the first round of quickening cards. And that means you would have to win either 20 tournaments, 20 quickenings, and or trade for them.
Yeah, because they didn't always send you. It's not like they kept a list of like, okay, Norm's got like the Kurgan quickening, he's got the Mito's quickening, he's got this quickening and that quickening. They just send you whatever they had. So right. You might have, because I have doubles of like some of them, and so it's like, you know, so then you would have to try and find somebody to trade with that didn't have, that had a quickening that you wanted, that they would, you know, just do the whole trade thing. So I know all of us at that time, we kind of pretty much sworn that we wouldn't buy quickenings. It was kind of like, you know, just not a cool thing to do.
It was not done. You had to earn it.
Right.
Yeah. Nothing's given. Everything's earned. But when you got one of those doubles, sometimes you're like, well, I could either send it back in. Because Thunder Castle Games was actually pretty good about exchanging a double for something that you didn't have. I mean, they were cool because they don't know. I mean, they didn't have a database
right. That
did that. They would just send out the random quickening with a tournament package. And so in the tournament package, you would have your quickening that went to the winner. You would have your five promo cards. Right?
Well, the quickening, the tournament packages always worked out that they would send those to me, the tournament director. And it would have like a stack of like eight promo cards, like a bunch of rips.
Uh-huh.
And like your Chessex, I can't think of the other promos off the top of my head, Scotland the Brave, things like that. All those different promo cards that they would publish. But the quickenings actually, because you had to be a Nexus member, and they would mail them directly to you. They wouldn't send them to the tournament director.
That's right.
That way, so then you would, because I remember like, I don't know how many times you guys like, I didn't get my quickening yet. I'm like,
I don't know what to
say. So, yeah, it's like talk to Sam and Terry. Right. But so it was you know, it was kind of like at the time we were just like really wanted to play, and like so since I was an instructor at the Cubert School and had a studio there, I had talked to, you know, the powers that be, and they let us use the cafeteria. So on Thursday nights we would, you know, the guys would come over, Norman Warren and Mike Chen and a bunch of other guys, and we would all go up to the cafeteria. And we would play like a tournament, and like we had to have eight players. So we started like recruiting everybody we could just so we'd have eight players to run a legal tournament.
That's right.
Yeah. Cause you have your double elimination. So like, you know, you have to have your bottom tier of guys, and the winner is always going up against like the next guy that won. And then you have the guys who lost going up against each other in the bottom tier until eventually it's just down to two, and there can only be one. Right. So,
well, I mean, since you were the tournament director and we tried to build communities at the time, I do remember it was a little bit of a struggle until we kind of started going to the tournament scenes and meeting new people and telling them like, hey, we have this facility, come and join us.
Yeah. I mean, that's how like we went out to, I remember we went out to that. It was like a shop that was running a tournament out in Long Island. And that's where we met Miguel and some friend of his that was out there at the time. That's the guy that I said that was the rules lawyer. So that's how Miguel started coming to our tournament. So he would drive all the way out from Long Island, like every Thursday night or every other Thursday night that we ran a tournament. And like, you know, so we could all play. And, you know, so then, and then afterwards we'd usually go to the Dover Star Diner and eat really bad disco fries. And well, they were good awesome. Disco fries, but bad for you. Yeah, but I have lots of girth here that I've been carrying for years, and I think I can name about like five spots that are probably disco fried.
You know, when at the end of all of the like the tournaments and or the Thursday nights, I think the thing, Mike, that you and I always took to that next level was that we always continued breaking down the game. You know, it was like, did the deck work? Did it not work? Did the timing work? Did it not work?
Yeah, because I mean that was another thing that was important in the process of building your decks. It's, you know, I mean, I know Norm and I and Warren all did the same thing. We had our you know, like our master binders that had all of the cards in them, you know, for the collecting purposes. So I mean, I don't know, remember like any time, like if I'm sitting around my apartment, like, you know, eating a sandwich or whatever, and I would just kind of flip through the binder and just kind of read through the stuff. That's how you familiarize yourself with the cards. But also then as you're flipping through different binders, you go, oh, that's how I actually stumbled upon the Kurgan follow-up thing. With you know, I was just flipping through like probably my movie edition binder, and I saw that, you know, Connor's master attack or master's lunge, I think it was, was unblockable, but you could dodge it. But if it was, that's when I put together the follow-up thing with, you know, so like follow-up makes it undodgeable. So it's just like, you know, it's just a killer combination, like three easy points. You just whittle your opponent down. So it was just a matter of like, we would do that. But then there's also the process of like, okay, you build your deck. You go, okay, you have to have your minimum requirement of blocks and attacks. And then, you know, and then I always try to keep everything to like a 60 card balance to start with. That way, like, you know, as you shuffle every three cards, you should have something you can use. And it's just a little game, you know, game math there, which math isn't my thing, but that worked for me. And then I would like I'd get the 60 together, and then I would build the deck. And I used to have this little Word document that I used to keep on my computer, and I would just like plug in the Immortal that I was trying to build. And I just ran across a bunch of those a few weeks ago.
Oh, really?
So those are kind of, yeah. I had like the beginning of a Martin Hyde deck that I so desperately still would love to build, but because I just thought Hyde could be like a really cool player to play.
You know, and you and I and Warren, we all kind of followed along every single expansion that came out, you know, from the series edition all the way to kind of like when we saw the beginning of the end of the game, you know, when
around Arms and Tactics.
Yeah, because there were rumors of like the company wasn't doing well and they weren't paying their bills. And I don't want to say too much about it because I wasn't there and I don't know the facts specifically, but the last two sets that came out were the Duncan and Mythos sets, and those were pretty much your pay-to-win sets. Do you remember, like, how did you feel about those when you came out? Because they were advertised in Castle News, and, you know, we kind of looked at the pricing, and we're like, okay, so if you spend X amount of this and you get these power cards, you pretty much will win.
Yeah, that I thought, in a lot of ways, that was kind of lame. But I mean, I understand the thought process behind it, but they didn't have to make it. I mean, I think people would have bought the sets anyway, just because they're, you know, the collectors. But they wanted people to buy like multiple sets of those so that they could build a deck out of it. Mm-hmm. So at $100 a piece, you know, I mean, you'd have to, in order to really get that together and working smoothly, you'd have to probably spend like $200-$300 to have like a full set to really pull through. Now, granted, eventually, I think the prices came down a little bit, and I bought like multiple decks of them too. But I mean, I remember like I think was it Warren's head you took in a tournament where you did the Master League sweep headshot.
There's a part in the notes actually we can get to called our most memorable moments, and this was at the New Jersey State Champions. I think it was 1998. The next year, it was the year after you won.
Yeah, it was the Shorecon the next
year. And Warren was playing probably his best deck at the time, which was his, and for the card gamers out there, so listen to this, because this deck was brilliant. It was his Fast Talk Lean and Mean deck, which basically was a 44 card deck. This is before Fast Talk was signatured, so he was still able to get his premium Darius +1/+3 on Fast Talk. So that thing cycled through. Long story short, in the in one move, he was able to hit me for 15 points of damage. 15. And I was, I held on to one card, and the card was Duncan's Master's Headshot. So the sequence was, I remember, Warren hit me for 15 points of damage with a Fast Talk. There's nothing I could do about it. My rip was gone. He played his second Fast Talk. he had the rapier parrying blade combo, and he hit me with so much damage. And I said, okay, well, there's nothing I can do about that. So the tournament scene started gathering around, because there were a lot of oohs and ahs, you know, like that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that.
So this was Duncan's. This was Duncan's collector's set. In his collector's set, he had probably the most broken cards, but it didn't matter against Fast Talk, because Fast Talk prevented me from doing anything in my hand. So I held on to one card. I was like, you know what? If I'm going to go out like Duncan, I'll go out swinging. So it was Duncan's Master's Headshot. And I know a lot of the card gamers out there are like, oh, really? Well, you know. So I held on to Duncan's Master's Headshot. It was the only card that I had in my hand. Warren went for a Power Blow Thrust for his coup de grace. He wanted to completely like eliminate my card hand. So I had to exert. I had to basically find a defense from the top five cards on my deck. And on the fifth card, I flipped them face up. On the fifth card, I found a jump. Now, long story short, for the people that aren't card gamers out there, what the combination basically did was it gave me an unblockable, undodgeable headshot. Just
hidden
like Duncan.
Headshot.
Hidden headshot. Because it's like Duncan jumping over his opponent and taking him out from behind. That's literally what happened if you looked at it from the standpoint of the TV show.
Yeah, he did that a couple times, like against Canis and against Luther, I think.
Yeah, you know, you're right. And
I just watched some of those the other day. So
that's kind of like one of those, wow, I did that Duncan MacLeod moment. And, you know, I was literally like, I got beaten to a pulp. But, you know, he just kind of like dug deep and I chose the right card. Luck, as it were.
Grant, it's not luck, it's gameplay.
I stacked that to be my fifth card on my defense, right? But it was one of those things where you're like, how did, you know, it's still probably my most fondest memory, because not just because it was the win, it's just how it happened. And
right.
It was either against Warren, or if it was against Mike or the other Mike, I'm glad it was against one of us, because that kind of like was the beginning of the end of our careers in Highlander, because 98, 99 wasn't really good for the product at the time. And I think it really started to die out in 99, and it was pretty much gone off retail. So it was a little bit of a bittersweet kind of win too, because I won with a completely like power decked, stacked deck, you know, bot deck with the Duncan. You know, it was like, I'm not saying that my gameplay wasn't bad or good. It was just that card. That card in particular was ridiculous.
Let's put it this way. You had enough gameplay and sense of the game to keep that as your last card. Most people would have kept a defense instead of like an attack.
Well, you can't. You're right. Because in gameplay, it's like, if I can take his head out, I still win.
Right. You can win at zero.
Exactly.
As my other story points out. So, I mean, that's always the thing that I loved. It's like, and, you know, and to give Warren credit, he would come up with some of the funkiest deck designs. His Nakano Mountain Cave deck, was it Mountain Cave or was it?
I think it was Nakano Mountain Cave, because he liked the whole Highlander 3, the Final Dimension dynamic.
Right, yeah.
You know, with the swords, I mean, to snakes and throwing out special cards for hiddens and stuff like that. So,
yeah, I think that was that tournament that you're talking about with the Duncan deck you had. It was not too long after the Watchers edition came out, and because I was playing a Caradwyn deck that I was trying to get to work, but I didn't have enough time to play test it, so it wasn't as the mechanics behind it were good, but like I didn't have enough time to really test it out, because she had a pretty cool ability too.
Yeah,
and her allies, she was the ally deck.
I think the thing that was tough about Highlander towards the end was not only there were a lot more mortals to choose from, but now because we were really into the tournament scene, we weren't probably risking as much in terms of like testing out different strategies. And we did like internally, but when we went to the tournaments, we went with our, you know, with our tried and trues.
Right. Yeah, 'cause you want to make sure that you're putting your best foot out there. So like, and also too, the other thing that I saw happening was as you know, once somebody came up with a good strategy for like a particular persona, which is why like all the tournaments for the longest time were Katana decks.
Yep, that was the meta. Yep.
And then like, but there was, I remember reading stories of like, I think it was Bill Chen, who would always play like his Slan the Cat deck.
Mm-hmm.
And he would, because he, the same 97 when I won the New Jersey championship, that made me, that put me in a position to go play the Nationals at I want to say it was Gen Con, but it was in Columbus, Ohio. So I don't know if it was Gen Con.
That was Origins.
Origins. That's what it was. Yeah. And it was a Northeast Regional, I think. And I placed fourth in that one. And like, I had a couple guys that I went up against that were playing their Katana decks. And but they had some errata for stuff. So like, you know, they weren't quite as shut down as they were. And I was able to make it I placed fourth in that tournament. And I think Bill beat me to a pulp in seconds with his slam deck, which I think I was probably playing Connor or somebody. I can't, it wasn't my Mountain Cave deck. Cause I had retired that one after that.
Okay.
But it was like, I mean, it was just like to be beaten by slam that quickly was kind of humiliating.
You remember what the tempo was of his deck?
I think it was a slam catwalk.
Okay. So
you could only use back away.
And slam like, only had back aways.
Right. And that's the same thing with Kurgan. So like, so your hand gets glutted with dodges if you had like a lot of other dodges in there. So like, you know, you can't cycle out as much. Mm-hmm. And then I think he was just, you know, hitting you with the back, you know, so you could only back away. And he was just pounding on you. It was probably like a lot of power blows, I'm guessing.
And he probably Dariused his shooting blade, so he was doing two.
Right.
Yeah, so that's four times two. That's 8 points of unblockable and dodgeable, no back away, no dodgeable damage.
Right.
Yeah, which is stupid.
It worked.
But it worked. You're right. That's the mechanics.
I think I remember reading his deck design and his play in one of the Thundercastle newses. Like they would give write-ups of like what people were playing and how they were playing it, so... But because somebody else actually won the national championship that year against Bill, and they were playing, I'm trying to think what the hell they were playing. It was like a Kronos deck or something.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, because Warren built a really nice Kronos deck too. I remember like we played at another tournament, just me and him, and like he kicked my ass with that thing.
So what we're trying to do here, I mean, aside from like going down memory lane, is one of the things that we wanted to do for the Blood of Kings fan group is you could probably tell if you are on the fan page that we actually have a sister page that covers just the card game material, because we want to be able to have all the card game players come in and share their ideas. Stephen Rice, who is handling the new editions right now, has done a brilliant job with keeping the card game going in the hearts and minds of the fans. But one of the things, Mike, that you and I talked about was trying to do some type of Skype play, like what we're doing now, because Mike and I are Skyping right now on this podcast, and we're video Skyping, so we can literally like put a camera that focuses on either side of our gaming area, and we could actually play the card game. We could even probably even hold up the card and say, this is the card that I'm playing. So is that something, Mike, that you feel that you and I and Warren could probably make a little bit more successful so that we can probably grow an actual online group of players?
There's something I mentioned to you a little while ago, and Warren as well. And Warren and I are going to try and give it a shot and just see how the mechanics work of it. Cause there's no reason I'm Skyping on my iPad that I can't take it and prop it up. So it just, you know, like viewing like the playing area that I'm playing at. And like, you know, so two players play, you have a half an hour time limit, and then you would message the tournament runner, which I guess, and I'll do one for sure. And just say, okay, well, you know, I lost, you know, to Jim, who took me with a headshot and blah, blah, blah. So then I would go through and I would, you know, what I figure I could do is just like fill in the sheet on my end and then just do like a group chat and like message everybody with, okay, the next round is going to be Norm against Warren and me against, you know, whoever. And yeah, you just run the tournament that way. I think it's a very, and I'll see. I think I might have a lot of old promo cards laying around, so I would definitely put up some promo cards for tournament winners.
Nice.
Might be a little more limited than it used to be.
Well, another thing that I wanted to tell all of the people out there that are like thinking about getting into the card game is that there is a really, really deep secondary market on eBay or in the auction places that you find online, because It's not a game that you can find really out there on the retail shelves. So if you want to get like a really nice collection, there are different ways you can go about it. On the Blood of Kings page, you can search out James Richards. James is somebody who has a pretty deep collection of cards that he is making available to like all of the interested parties out there. And again, there are like Dallas Baker. He has a page on eBay, and you can find him online. And then there are just other, you know, resellers that have a lot of stock from the old game. And then Stephen Rice is also continuing the second edition of the game, which is the white bordered card. And those are right now available for tournament, actually legal tournament purposes. I do believe that there's going to be also a showing and tournament scene at Gen Con this year. So visit Blood of Kings, the CCG page on Facebook, and you'll be able to find a little bit more information there. We're going to keep you up to date on all of that so that any people that want to get into the card game, if you've never tried it before, I actually had a couple of starter decks with me when I went to Adrian Paul's dinner. So I handed them out to people who wanted to try the card game. And that's just the way that it's the old school way of seeding a new group of players, is just have sample packs with you and see if they want to give it a go. So before we wrap up the show, Mike, I mean, I would love to be able to do this for another couple more hours, and I'd love to have you back, you and Warren, and talk about how we're going to move the online play forward. But do you have any final thoughts, just kind of going back memory lane and bringing up our old, I mean, ladies and gentlemen, like Mike and I have literally been friends for like almost like 20 years now, you know?
I mean, yeah, more than that. Yeah. It's like 95, like since you were like, I mean, we wound up hanging out because you were one of my students, but yeah. Yeah, so like we've been playing and like, you know, Highlander Nerds for like way back.
Yeah, and we've always kept in touch about it as much as we could. Social media has done a really good job of helping us do that through Facebook and Twitter and such. But we go back. We're two of our own four horsemen, because our four horsemen at the time was me, you, Warren, and Mike.
Right.
And that was our very first tournament, so it means a lot to both of us to be able to come online, talk about our Highlander memories, and share a lot about that with you. And we want you to be able to do that too. So, you know, not to get too verklempt here, but Mike, anything left to say for the show?
For the show, yeah, I think it's a great game, and I still think the gameplay is awesome. I just like at the end of my year of teaching at the Kubert School, I had an assignment where we did a review. And then after the final bit of artwork and everything was done, I brought in a bunch of Highlander demo decks that we used to demo at stores like in the area.
But just recently?
Just recently, yeah, like back in May, like when the last day of school.
Nice.
And so I brought in a bunch of like comics and hardcovers and blank sketchbooks that I had. And so I made a tournament. So like whoever played, you know, if you won, you got like the sketchbook you got to pick the sketchbook or the comic book or the hardcover or whatever.
Well, fine.
And so like I got a bunch of like, you know, students playing, and they seem to really enjoy it. So I'm hoping like next year when I teach, like I can only imagine this was Mike Chen's idea. Like Wednesday nights is game night at the Kubert School. After like during the lab portion of the day, which is at the end of the day, They do a lot of role playing games. So if I come back when I come back the next year, I'm going to like try and do some stuff with the Highlander card game and like see if I can just buy starter decks, you know, cape boxes online and stuff, and run little tournaments.
Right. For those of us veteran fans out there and people who have kind of like limped along with the game after it was gone, there's nothing better than just trying to find a pickup game and then just scratching that itch, because as fans of Highlander, that's what we did. It was kind of like mental food for thought, and it was just great to be able to break out a deck or talk about a memory or create new memories, because I still think that this game is the best game that I've ever played. It's the best card game I've ever played, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Easily.
Well, Mike, before we wrap up here, I just wanted to go over a few final closing notes, and I can't even tell you guys, like, and you could probably tell by the podcast, like how much this means to me. Being able to discuss the Highlander card game with Mike, I mean, that's like a real treat for me. I think it is for him too. But this isn't the only topic that we've been talking about here on the Fandom Podcast Network this past week. So just to remind everyone, the Fandom Podcast Network, or the FPN, hosts a wide variety of shows that cover a lot of different topics from the world of all things geeky. So recently on our Culture Clash show with Kevin and Kyle, they went deep into the Game of Thrones series finale on HBO. They took a really in-depth look at the Star Wars Episode 8 rumors and reviewed the Entertainment Weekly article that just dropped. Also, we're putting the final touches, and you've heard this on several shows before, for our format for Couch Potato Theater, which is our B-movie and cult classic review show. And I think that we're going to be starting off the very first show with Megaforce, but I think that Kevin and I are kind of jockeying for position on that because I'd like to start either with Last Starfighter or Krull or Big Trouble in Little China. I mean, those are my favorites for Couch Potato Theater. So stay tuned for that. We'll make sure that we get all the details out for you before
Big
we launch that show. Right? Big Trouble. Exactly, Mike. And I'd like to thank, again, all of our fans and listeners who are sticking with us. Thanks for following us and posting your reviews online. You can always find us on the Blood of Kings fandom group page on Facebook. And we appreciate all your support. So thanks for all of your tweets and emails and all of the love that you show us there on the Fandom Network podcast page. So if you'd like to find us on all things social media, you can find us on the Fandom Podcast Network on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, and newly Google Play for all of you Android users. You can find us on Blood of Kings on Facebook, and you can also find us on Blood of Kings, a Highlander CCG page on Facebook. You can email us at bloodofkingspodcast@gmail.com. You can also tweet us at bloodofkingspod on Twitter. If you'd like to find Kevin, who is right now, again, on Watcher Assignments, or I'm not even going to BS you on that. He is on the most fantastic vacation of all time, and he's going to come back with some great stories on visiting the Highlands on his trip. So you can find him, exactly, right? You can find him on @Spartan_Phoenix, and you can find me on Twitter @Starfighter1701. We'd love to hear from you on iTunes, so if you'd like to leave us a 5-star review, if we've earned it for you, please do so, so that we can increase our search engine optimization and increase our feed visibility there on iTunes. And just again, I wanted to tell you about Adrian Paul's signing in Burbank on July 23rd. So don't forget about that. It's a great way to meet our hero of Highlander. So before I close the show, I think that, Mike, you have a pretty good announcement that you'd like to make. And I want to give you enough time to be able to tell everyone about the special project that you're working on.
Thanks, Norm. I'm working on, let me just sit back here again. I'm working on a Kickstarter project. It's my own creator-owned property. It's a comic book called The Adventures of Seamus and Gray. And you can find it, I'll be launching a Kickstarter hopefully later this afternoon, if I can get through all the minutia of launching a Kickstarter.
And we're recording, when Mike says this afternoon, it is the afternoon of July 2nd.
Okay. Yeah, so go check it out. The website is synergystudiospub.com, and from there there'll be links to the Kickstarter page, or you can look up The Adventures of Seamus and Gray, and Seamus is spelled Shamus on Kickstarter, and you should be able to find it as well. But and also I have a Facebook page, Mike Sellers. Just go there, and I'll have announcements about it there too. If you like your urban fantasy and magic and like monsters and mayhem, check it out. I think it's a fun ride. It's a nice comic book drawn, co-written by me, and drawn, penciled by one of Norm's classmates, Scott Dalrymple, and inked by me. And then I do all of the lettering and production work on it as well. So come check it out. It's going to be a fun ride.
And on Twitter, Mike, anyone on Twitter, anything there?
I have a Twitter. I got to say, I barely use it. But Twitter is MCell CNL. MCell is all lowercase, CNL is uppercase. That's also my website is CNLstudios.com.
Okay, and CNL is short for circle and line, I believe.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. No one could spell it correctly, so I shortened it to CNL. Myself included, so. But I'm the world's worst speller, so.
And then you'll also can find Mike on the Blood of Kings page and the Blood of Kings CCG page, because Mike is really going to be in tune with bringing a lot of that content out for all of the CCG fans.
Yep, that is the mission. Okay.
So, and I've seen a little bit of Mike's project of Seamus and Gray. It's fantastic, folks. Again, it's a really cool urban fantasy story. And I'm glad that you hooked with Scott, because, folks, in my class, there were two artists out there that were really outstanding. One was Alex Maleev. And you've seen his work out there in Batman and Daredevil and other titles. But the other standout performer in my class who went 2 years to the school was Scott Dalrymple. And he's a great guy. He's a fantastic artist. So is Mike. Mike's like a brother to me. And I'd like for all of you to show them a lot of love and find their Kickstarter project, really take an honest look at it and donate as you can. If there are perks there that you think that you would like to have, please take a look at those perk packages. Mike, I think you said that you're going to have some really nice autographed material there too.
There's going to be a printed comic. There's a lot of digital comics versions of it. We're going to have sketch cards. I'm going to sell some of my original artwork from the comic work I've done, like X-Men, X-Man, and some other things. Other things I've created. So,
now, Mike, you've been an inker in comics professionally for how long now?
Since like the early 90s.
Okay, and you've worked for DC and Marvel and
DC, Marvel, Wildstorm, Dark Horse. I inked the Gamera miniseries for Dark Horse years ago.
I did that with you. I was doing the background.
Yeah, I just sold the last few pages a couple weeks ago at a convention.
So Mike has a lot of original artwork at his, for the perks out there. And if you're a fan of original comic book arts, please take a look at those perk packages. So support the Kickstarter. This is the way I think that you're getting actually really good creator-owned original content nowadays. And I think that Kickstarter is a great way for you to be able to support, artists, like Mike, who are putting out some really nice, new, and fresh material. So anything left to say, Mike?
Yeah, not everybody wants, like in comics, it's like not everybody wants to see their fiction with guys wearing underwear on the outside of their pants. We're doing something a little different. Give us a shot.
Absolutely, folks. That's Seamus and Gray. It'll be on Kickstarter later on this afternoon of July 2nd. Now, when we post this show, it'll probably be a week from now. So we're gonna post links to it on the Blood of Kings page as we update everyone on this show so that you can actually see the Kickstarter as it launches. So for me, this was a really great treat for me. It was great to visit with Mike again and talk about Highlander. I mean, we love Highlander. We love the card game. We love the TV show, the movies. Again, one of the reasons why I'm still a big of a fan as I am is because of Mike and I playing off of each other and sharing that collected energy and being able to reconnect like this. So on behalf of Kevin, who... screw Kevin. He's on a great trip. I mean, I'm tired of giving him credit on. He's on a trip right now of a lifetime. He's going to enjoy himself, and we can't wait to have him back behind the mic. So thanks, everyone, for listening. Join us again next time here on the Fandom Podcast Network for another episode of Blood of Kings. And, Mike, the sensation you're feeling is the quickening. We are one. We are brothers. Goodbye, everyone.